You and your degenerate friends already waste enough time thinking about disc golf. But just in case, here's some extra material on the Fish Golf Broadcast. On this episode of the Fish Golf Broadcast, I have somebody who doesn't have anywhere else to talk about Frisbee, so he's got to come here. Paul Uliberry. Paul, what you thinking about?
I'm thinking about how true that really is.
All right, well, that's our show.
Which means I have a lot to talk about.
You've been storing it up for like 15 years, 15 plus years of touring now?
Yes, and not being able to get my thoughts out there to the public.
You've always been a guy with a lot of thoughts. You've been on the Disc Golf Tour, Disc Golf Pro Tour Player Council. You were the inaugural chair of the PDGA Pro Touring Players Committee. And with your wealth of experience, you're someone that a lot of folks have looked up to as like the tour vet that they can go to with questions. Additionally, you're the Discraft team player captain, right?
Co-captain?
Yeah.
Now with Missy Gannon. So yes, that is also correct, which is nice to have Missy now on board to kind of take a little of the stresses out with that hat that I wear.
Can you talk about what's under that hat? Like, what do you have to do as a team captain? Because that's a relatively new role in the disc golf sponsorship ecosystem.
Yeah. Well, I feel like when you think of team captains in other sports, it's typically the same thing. It's somebody who's probably been around a while, or somebody who's working harder than everybody, or somebody who's just really dang good. Mm-hmm. At one point in my life, I've been all those things, I think. And so as a captain, you have to be a leader, of course, mm-hmm. a leader of the team. There's all kinds of different ways to lead. And I like to do it by example. So, for example, if I have, let's say, newcomers come to the team and they're like, hey, what can I do to, you know, help Discraft, help my career along, and then I tell them something and I'm not doing it, I feel bad as a leader. And so that's one of the reasons and has pushed me to do all kinds of different things in the game, right? So from the commentary to the social media to the vlogs to podcasts to playing, practicing, all of those things, I feel like that helps me be a good leader for our team. And there's other things that I have to do as well. Like if it's unfortunate that one of our players has some sort of mishap on the course or isn't representing the company well or says something maybe they're not supposed to, in the public eye, I'm the guy that has to call them and be like, hey, tone it back, or we don't like that you do that, or you're kicked off the team. So it can be at all kinds of different levels.
Well, somehow, I've managed to avoid that up to this point.
That's why I'm on this podcast. Ooh, man. I was sent here by Bob, and he told me to tell you you're out of here, dude. You're done. And now this is my podcast.
So Zach Melton has already taken over this podcast. Okay. You'll need to talk to him. But so what are you going to rename it?
Going Fishing with Paul Uliberry.
Awesome. That's a great name. Thank you. We can throw that on all kinds of merch.
No, but back to your question. So there's just lots of different things as a captain. I also have to, collab with Bob and Mike on a lot of different things. So I'm allowed in conversations that other people probably aren't. I know information that is deep in the company that probably other people don't.
And I have a pair of pliers and you have some fingernails, so.
Yeah. I don't think that'll do it. I got a zipper on these lips.
There you go. So I follow baseball really closely. I know you're into a whole lot of sports. I read an interview with Braves general manager Alex Anthopoulos in which he was talking about their current strategy for filling holes on the Braves roster. Mm-hmm. The Braves have done a really good job of signing young players to extensions and locking up a good player core. And that's led them to not having to compete with like the big free agent market. That's led them to finding guys that they think are underutilized or undervalued by their current teams and targeting them specifically in trades or free agency. Discraft has kind of done the same thing. Like, you had Paul McBeth. And then there are guys like Adam Hammes and Anthony Barella who have come over, as well as filling out the women's team. And, you know, maybe Missy has more of a say in that aspect right now. But Discraft has a really solid player team. What do you think that you would be looking for in adding more bodies to the squad?
Well, that's part of the conversation that I would say that would be private between Bob, Mike, and I, which is interesting because there's three different opinions of what do we want the, what I say we, what do they want the company to look like?
Sure.
And then I have a little input, right? And it goes back and forth between, okay, I want somebody like, let's say, a early Paul Ulibarri who was just grinding C-tiers, B-tiers
yeah.
every single weekend. And then let's say Mike wants something else. He's like, okay, well, we kind of
want
to...
We want a world championship.
Yeah, we want a world championships, and we want some people who are going to be on coverage all the time. And then Bob comes in and says something different. You know, like, we want all three of those. We want them to do everything.
We want somebody who's selling plastic like crazy.
Exactly. So it's three minds, really, that and Missy as mm-hmm. well. So four minds now that are getting together and really trying to smooth out the details. And we've done a really great job with those things. Right now, I think we're focusing really hard on making sure that our elite team is as good as it can possibly be. And I like that because I feel like your team is only as good as your best player, really, and your worst player. And so if our worst player is just the worst player on the planet, that doesn't really look great for Discraft.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I envision, which I can really only talk about, like, what I would like for the company, right? I envision Discraft having 20 guys of just the best of the best of the best. I remember early on in my career when I wasn't sponsored and looking at somebody, let's say, that had a Discraft sponsorship or end of a sponsorship, and I remember just seeing, let's say, the wings, right? The wings on somebody's back, which I'm referring to Innova, or seeing the Discraft team logo on somebody's back, I remember being like, oh my gosh.
It's
like
a big deal.
That guy is a sponsored player. I feel like in the last 15 to 10 years, it's gotten watered down to where people have so many people on their team. You look at somebody and they're like, I'm sponsored. That doesn't tell me anything at this point, right? I could be like, okay, let me see them throw.
Or, sure.
I haven't heard of that guy before. I would like Discraft, when somebody sees that logo on their back, for them to have that same experience that I did, and they look at them and they'd be like, oh my gosh, they're on Team Discraft? Like, that's impossible.
Sure. And Discraft expanded their team and expanded their team as, like, let's say the national tour was the big game in town. And then it seemed like about the time that a lot of resources went toward McBeth, they started cutting that team back and developing the underground team. And there have been some really good call-ups to, like, full sponsorship from that underground level, right?
Yeah, 100%. So if you remember when McBeth came to Team Discraft, I also came.
Coattailing,
yeah. So I feel like some of these things that have happened, I've definitely had influence on. I'm part of the recruiting program that we have. Like, I recruit players. I say I have a real say in who comes and who goes. Obviously, it doesn't stop with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bob is our team manager, so he has the last say in pretty much everything, and Mike can even shut him down. So there's different people involved for sure, but one thing that all of us, I feel like, have Discraft as the best interest in all of this stuff, and when you think about that and what we've been able to do over the last few years, we've accomplished a lot. And it's been tough because I'm the guy who has to trim down, right? So I'm the guy who has to call them and be like, okay, yeah, but, you know, you're supposed to play 8 tournaments and you didn't, and we're going to have to let you go. And it's getting tougher and tougher because over the last few years, everybody's good.
Yeah.
Everybody's really, really good. So I'm having to cut some players that I've known for a very long time and I have respect for, and they have respect for me, and I have to have that tough conversation. But at the end of the day, when we think about the brand Discraft, since McBeth and myself have come on board, I really think we've done a great job of growing that into the best brand in disc golf and the most elite brand in disc golf, which for a long time, and people, you know, people will push back and say, well, Innova's still that. In my mind, I think that Discraft's number one right now, and it's part of my job to make sure that we stay that way.
Are there some underappreciated aspects to what you're considering in a player? Like, it's really easy to scroll down PDGA results and see, you know, a bunch of ones and twos on there, and that's great. And it's kind of easy to look at, say, social media following, but do you look at things like, you know, leadership in a local community, ability to install courses? Like, what are some things that don't necessarily show up, more intangibles?
Right. That's a great question, because that's something that we're trying to navigate right now, mm-hmm. and figure out what is important and what isn't important, and what's the number one thing for Discraft. Is it having that kind of grassroots, that guy's the guy here and he throws Discraft so everybody follows him? And it's very important. That is very important.
It's also harder now when there's, yes. you know, 300 manufacturers, yes, instead of five.
It is, but it's tough, because if you look at the grand scheme of things, which is what we really have to look at, and somebody is, let's say, Missouri's number one player, okay? And that person, everybody knows who that guy is, right? Everybody in Missouri loves this guy, and they buy the Discraft, and that guy's killing it. How many sales is that making, okay? So let's say in that year, because of the one player, he's selling 2,000 individual pieces of product from Discraft. Mm-hmm. That's probably pretty accurate, right? That's a lot of sales.
It's a good number, yeah.
That's a big number. Okay, but what about the guy who isn't beloved in St. Louis, and this guy has a huge social media following, and this guy is selling 6,000 individual pieces of product because his reach is not just in Missouri and it's all over the world. Who's more important? What is more important?
There's also the now of that, and then projecting it out.
Yes.
Like, maybe if you give that player with lower current numbers an opportunity to go national, maybe their reach expands well beyond what this other guy does. Well, you know, we're making up hypotheticals here.
For sure. But those are the tough questions that we have to ask ourselves, and then they're real numbers.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so that's tough. I personally have always been the guy to go to bat for the person who is local. My brother's a great example.
Sure.
Right? He's a local player in Arizona who runs a few tournaments a year, and they're the most popular tournaments in Arizona besides, let's say, the Memorial Shelly Sharp.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he runs a great tournament. He does great course design. He does great coaching. He also wins a lot.
Yeah.
And so if you go to Arizona and you talk to any amateur, pretty much, and you say, what do you think of Pete Uliberry? They go, he's the nicest person I've ever met in my life. And he's really good at putting. That's somebody, to me, that's more important than sales.
Because
to me,
it creates a very positive association
100%,
with them.
Right. Yeah. And it's a long lasting, like you said, like, somebody's going to have an impact from Pete Uliberry, and they're going to be like, no, I want to support this guy forever. This guy is my guy. But if you're a numbers person and you want sales,
which is ultimately Discraft's bottom line.
It is. But I also think that Discraft has been great at wanting those things too.
Hmm.
Right. I really do. They've had, let's say C.R. Willie's been on the team for, I can't name the number, but he's been on the team forever. You know what I mean? So it's not like they're just like, okay, this guy's gone, that guy's gone. Or somebody like Michael Johansson, who's not playing on the tour anymore, but at a time did. Now he's that local guy, and he gets a lot of support. So I think this conversation is tough because, like I said, there's basically 3 to 4 to 5 people talking about what's right and what's good and everything, and then balancing all of those things together to make the best brand possible. And I'll go back to the point of, I think we've done a really good job of doing that and balancing those things. But as the sport grows and the bottom line becomes higher and higher and higher, things have to change. Things will push in one direction or another, and I don't know where that's going. That's a year-to-year basis. as a sport grows into an actual sport with more and more publicity, more and more screen time, more and more big networks picking us up, getting known worldwide, not nationally, those questions will get harder and harder, and those decisions will get harder and harder to figure out how to keep Discraft ahead of everybody else.
Mm-hmm. I'm Connor Rock, and I listen to the Fish Golf Broadcast while I spit seeds.
I'm Zach Garlinghaus, and I listen to the Fish Golf Broadcast while I learn how to swim.
You know, I spent all of season one in this very ad break saying that we would never barrage you with 11 minutes of droning external ads. But lately, I've had a change of heart. The integrity of this show absolutely has a price. We're talking lake house money. Private island money. Lake house on a private island money. But until that hypothetical benevolent corporate overlord speaks up, though, this show is entirely supported by your support of me and my sponsors. Fish Stamp Discraft discs are available in-store and online at daddydiscgolf.com, dischub.com, and treemagnets.com, and fishdiscgolf.com when I'm not traveling. You can save 10% at Grip Equipment with the code FISHGIFT10 at checkout, unless you're a fool who likes spending full price on disc golf bags. And of course, our name is derived from Disc Golf Bra, whose media channels and website you should visit for outstanding New England content. And now, more mutual hostility between Fish and the guest. All right, Paul, so you've been touring for, is it 15?
This is my 16th year.
16th year on tour. During that time, the game has evolved and the courses have evolved, but also you've evolved. It seems to me like in the, let's say, 12 years that I've been following disc golf, you've kind of reinvented yourself several times. Is that an accurate perception? How do you see yourself?
Yeah, I mean, you have to. It's weird because I've been a good player for a long time, but the sport changes, you know, over time. And like you said, you have to kind of, I've seen a lot of players from my generation that were here for a good amount of time, and now they're gone.
Okay.
I have always had the goal of being here forever and being a household name for as long as I can possibly do it. I feel like with the changes, it's getting tougher and tougher and tougher to do those things, especially on the course with the courses changing and things like that that you had mentioned. But I don't know, I feel like my personality trait is one that I'm going to push myself as far as I can go. And so far, that push is, and my athleticism and my frisbee background and I guess my drive has all equaled out to keep me in the loop.
You're a tour grinder, somebody who always played lots and lots of events, but you're also like a round grinder. You can take a bogey on the first hole and it kind of doesn't seem to matter.
That's just from playing forever, you know? One of the things, it's funny because I have a full-time caddy, Brad Hammack, who's also a legend of the game, 7-time world champion, 5 Masters, 2 doubles world championships. But anyways, we get in arguments on the course because he'll see me get down and get into a negative space, and that worries him into him thinking that I'm not trying, right? Hmm. And then I'll birdie like 5 in a row or something like that. And for the first like year to year and a half, that was a big worry for him because he was a different player. He was somebody who was super hyper focused kind of all the time and would really try to not let the negative stuff get to him. I've always had like this thing in my mind to where I know I'm good. I know if you give me enough holes, I'm going to start to birdie. And knowing that and believing that makes taking bogeys and stuff okay. But over the last couple of years, I've taken more and more bogeys, so it gets harder and harder and harder to have that mentality. But I appreciate you saying that.
You've also, there have been times when you've been really, really forehand reliant, and then other times when it's been, you know, lots of backhands, like ripping drivers through the woods, even if that's not the smart play. It's just the play that you're into at that time.
Yeah, I think that comes from a few things. With the game changing and the players getting so good, I found myself having to figure out ways to get better and to maintain whatever skill level I have. And with that takes a lot of sacrifice. So I am a smart player. I know the correct play. But sometimes when taking the grand scheme into picture, if I were to play smart all of the time, I feel like I would lose a scoring opportunity. And not only a scoring opportunity, a plan to get better, right? Like if I'm taking the safe play constantly, eventually with how the course design's getting, it's going to run me over and I won't be able to do that anymore. And so I've forced myself to be very aggressive in tournaments in the past, just because I feel like if I can get aggressive and not do the safe play, and that will get me better at those tough, difficult shots, I'm learning a new way to score. And if I'm learning a new aggressive way to score, once I take the safe and that all comes together someday, that's a winning recipe, right? Coming down the stretch and be able, like for example, coming down to the stretch is what I'm planning on,
mm-hmm.
and having a 5-stroke lead. Because of the long career that I've had and the ability to then take the safe play, I can pad, let's say, my score and
win the tournament. You got strokes to burn, yeah.
If I'm trailing coming down the stretch of a big tournament, I can get aggressive and go after those holes.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm stuck in the mindset of a one-way player, I don't think that opportunity suits me, if that makes sense. My plan is to win a major. That's all I've ever thought about for the last decade, right? That's what my practice is. Every single tournament is with the thought of, okay, major situations, this is how it's going to go. I want to put myself in the toughest situations possible. And I still believe that will happen. So my play is for those situations. And it looks like, oh, Paul's being an idiot and throwing these crazy shots or blah, 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 blah. But it's really training for just one time that I have a chance,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to be able to do it. And I feel like mentally, because of doing those things, I should have a calm, somewhat of a calm sensation once I'm in that situation and be able to close.
That's awesome. Like, all of us want that major. Everything else can be a stepping stone to that.
Yes.
You've also like reinvented your putt. I know there was a while when it didn't seem like you had a feel for it. And then last year, you switched something and became the greatest putter in the world, even if it didn't look amazing.
Yeah.
How'd you do that?
I broke it down, really. You know, it was actually pretty simple. My whole career, I felt like I was a great putter in my mind.
Uh-huh.
And my abilities didn't match up. A couple times they did. Like, I had a couple seasons where I putted really well, but for the most part, I feel like I've probably been known as not a great putter. Stretches of brilliance, of course, like anybody,
yeah.
but an average putter. And I finally just broke it down into a simple concept that made sense to me. And it's going to sound silly, but all I did is take a piece of paper and design a robot that made every 20-footer. Like, I just was like, okay, this is if I designed a robot and it made every single putt, what would it look like? And so I did that. I'm not a engineer, but I can design a robot hypothetically that should work, right?
All you need to do is trick yourself into becoming that robot. Yes. So you just design it in your head. Yeah.
So I designed it on a piece of paper and I said, okay, this is how the putt works. If I design this robot, this is definitely a robot that's going to make every single 20 footer. And then I match my form to that robot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all it was. Really, it was that simple. And it took time. It took a lot of time. And I'm still struggling with distance for this putt that I have. But over time, I think my range is going to get deeper and deeper and deeper. And I'm going to become a better and better and better putter.
Sick. I mean, that's Masters golf. You're not ready for that yet. But just making every putt. Do you have any other inventions that you're in progress on? Like, is there a 600-foot robot Yuli?
I haven't gotten there yet. I haven't thought about that. I think right now, if I can master this putt and get, let's say, to my range to 40, 45 feet to where I'm the best putter in the world, I can win tournaments.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I'm focused on.
Sure.
I don't need this. I don't think if you gave me 500 feet right now that it's a winning recipe for my game, if it was just that. I think that I can birdie every single hole if I can knock down 45 footers every single time.
For sure.
Without a doubt. So that's and that makes sense in my mind. I think, not to go off topic.
There is no topic.
But if I think that there's a lot to be said about having a set game plan, not game plan, but a set way that you play, right? And if you switch something minor, like let's say you add another putt to your game, it might be a better putt. But the focus is going to waver during the round because you're going to be focused on this new thing. So you're going to throw your shot and then you're going to be like, oh, this is my new putt. And you're focused on something different instead of it just being free golf, right? Like you throw the drive and then you're putting. When you add something, you're throwing the drive and then you're trying a new putt. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And you might make it, but that's not a winning recipe. A winning recipe is zone. You're not thinking about anything. You're just execution, 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 and then end result.
And there's a bunch of players, or there's a bunch of different ways that players get locked into this at every level.
Yes.
There's, well, this putter's not working today, so I'm going to use the other one. Well, what if that other one doesn't work for you either? It turns out it was never the disc, it was the person putting it.
100%.
Or, you know, you've got that style. Or, like, something I found, I went back and played courses that I started learning on. And at that point, man, I couldn't fucking lose on those things because I would just hit a hyzer flip on every single one.
Yeah.
Well, now I've got a forehand. Now I can throw force overs. Now, like, I've got more distance. It's almost like being better at a whole bunch of other things made me worse at disc golf for a little bit. Like, there's a plateau that you have to get through.
But then once you learn to bring those all in and make the correct decision for your game in that moment, in that day, that's what a winning recipe is. Because, like I said, you can't win a tournament just being like, okay, I'm great at everything. You know? You really can't. Everything has to flow. Everything has to be crisp. Like, if I were to go out there tomorrow and push putt every single day, let's say, I'm a great push putter. Like, I can make pretty close to the same amount of putts that I do now, but the pressure of going up to that and not having it dialed into my game, like my tournament game, is going to make me not score, probably. You know what I mean? Now, if I did that for an entire year, next year, and then I switch back to the other putt, same thing. I might be a better putter, but it's not necessarily going to make me a better tournament player.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, Paul, I'm excited to see you continue your evolution. Last question that I want to get to. You and I have, I think, a fairly similar sense of humor. Like, love delivering a dry punchline and not reacting and letting the other person figure out if you were joking or not. Can you tell me about a time that you were in an interview or a first date or like another social situation where somebody didn't know your sense of humor and it completely didn't land?
Well, I honestly think, I don't know if it's so much a sense of humor with myself. I don't think people used to know that I had that sense of humor, which was interesting. I had a lot of people later on in my career, like in the last, let's say, 5-6 years, come up to me and be like, hey, man, I thought you were an absolute asshole. And then now I know who you are because of, like, the mentality that I had on the course. You know, I tell people I have, like, three different personalities that I work with, right? I have normal Paul Uliberry, who not a lot of people really know. You'd have to know me my whole life, you know. And then I have, let's say, on-screen Paul Uliberry, who is pretty close to normal Paul Uliberry. And then I have tournament Paul Uliberry, serious guy. And that guy, only competitors know, right? So when I'm on the course, typically, if I'm in the zone, don't talk to me. Don't look at me. If I want to talk to you, I'm going to talk to you. If not, leave me alone type thing. I go blank. Fan interaction probably isn't fantastic because I'm trying to stay focused. I'm trying to get wherever I'm going to and not get out of that zone. And so I had a lot of people who, let's say I have resting bitch face on the course, who are like, man, that guy's kind of a cocky asshole. Probably perceive me in a different way, to where if you get to know me, like you said, I like to laugh. I like to make jokes. I like to have fun. I think fun with your friends is some of the best times in your life.
Yeah, definitely. All right. So I said that was the last question. I'm going to extend this a little bit, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
We are in a player, fan, media, like very symbiotic relationship. Mm-hmm. And with the Pro Tour, they've kind of set aside an autograph line for after rounds, or they'll have other opportunities for fans to meet players at fly marts. And that's, you know, that's a really good place for you to potentially grow your brand outside of just commentary or something. But it's another layer of yourself that you have to get into. And it can be really tough to come down from being tournament yourself in 5 minutes to go, like, put on a happy face at the autograph tent and go meet a kid. Like, that's a day at work for you.
Yeah.
And every single weekend is another tournament in a different place. For that kid, it might be his first Pro Tour event that he's ever been to, and he is thrilled that the Pro Tour comes to town.
Yep.
It's a lot of responsibility for you, for the sport, for the Pro Tour, that you're putting yourself out there as.
Yeah, it is, and it's a tough line that you have to walk, because after a round, like, I can only speak on myself. After a bad round, I'm not in a good place. Like, period, right? So sometimes I skip the line. I would rather, honestly, that kid not see me like that than for me to go up there and be in the worst mood ever and sign his autograph and be resting bitch face Paul Ulibarri.
Or like pretty much lie to his face and like try to put on a half-hearted, hey buddy, how you doing?
Right, and I can do that, and I can do that sometimes. But a lot of times I would rather not do that because I don't want people to see me like that, just like anything. Like I said, it's a fine line you have to walk. And sometimes I can do it. Sometimes I can pop myself out, put on a smile, and go over there and be like, blah, 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 blah. But anybody who knows me knows I'm a pretty real person, and I wear my emotions on my sleeve. You pretty much know if I'm in a good mood or a bad mood right away, or medium mood. And most, I love...
He has had the biggest RBF this entire...
Exactly. But I care about my performance so much, it takes a lot out of me. And so bad rounds, because of all the things that I do, hurt. They really hurt. And it's not as easy as people might think to be able to be like, oh, nope, smile time. Hey, buddy, you're my favorite person I've ever seen in my life. Sometimes it's important for your game to allow yourself to be down for a little bit. Like, it's not healthy as an athlete to push those things down and compartmentalize that in a way, because then what happens if you've done it for 5 years, a kid comes up to you and asks you how you shoot, and then you come out and you're like, I had the worst round of my life. I wish you wouldn't ask me that out of nowhere, right? And that those things do happen in sports. Like, people have those situations happen. So I try to stay away from that situation sometimes. But I also feel like I'm very good with my fans, and I feel like they know that I love them, and the support is unbelievable with how many people actually follow me. And you know, last season I missed cash at the first 9 tournaments, and every single tournament I had people following me,
mm-hmm.
which means a lot, you know.
Yeah, it means you did something right.
Right. And so I have to, I guess I owe it to them to kind of be the person that I am, you know, and I'll get better at it. Like, mm-hmm. it's a give and take, to where I know I have to sit there for a little bit, but sometimes, like, this is a secret that I've never told anybody, but sometimes I would tell like a PDGA official, hey, tell them that I have an interview in like 5 minutes. So I'm not there for 20 minutes doing that. You know what I mean? And I feel like that's fair. I feel like that's fair.
Yeah. You, you are a human. Mm-hmm. You're a three-dimensional human with like hopes and dreams and fears and goals. And if you, fans come to tournaments wanting to see the best disc golfers play the best disc golf. And if part of your process needs to be like, needs to be no eye contact with anybody before you're around, if part of your process is like, you need to skip the autograph line today so that you can play better tomorrow and be in a better headspace to meet with those fans, folks need to recognize that. It can't be a chronic thing, but yeah, it can be a sometimes thing.
Well, I think with my own personality, people think of me as an extrovert, but I'm actually an introvert.
Yeah.
I'm very introverted with myself. Now, I can be extroverted, and I can for a short amount of time, but my happiest place is by myself, usually,
mm-hmm,
right? And that's why the anxiety that comes, it's a real anxiety that comes with a lot of players after you're round and you've played like donkey. Dealing with that anxiety is really hard. And the only way that, the most healthy way that I've found to deal with it is by myself, mm-hmm, and to give myself a moment to be like, okay, no, you're Paul Ulibarri, you're going to be fine. Like, there's always next tournament. While beating myself up sometimes and being like, how could you possibly miss all those shots? Like, you're a loser. Like, those are real things that we go through, you know, and we need time sometimes to be able to navigate those anxieties and thoughts that we have as athletes.
All right. Well, I feel like that takes us full circle from the role of team captain into, you know, how you haven't completely perfected the mental game even after this long playing. If you enjoyed this podcast and want to lavish praise on me, you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at fish58320. And if you hated this podcast, you found the guest, somebody who should probably just go find a different career, where can folks find you, Paul?
Well, I have to go in 5 minutes. I have an interview. So they can find me all over the place. Instagram, I have a lot of stuff on Instagram where I keep my fans updated. I have a YouTube channel that you can find just with my name. The Instagram is One Yuli. You can find me every weekend that there's a pro tour on Jomez Pro. And there's all kinds of different ways you can help me. But
And you've got a teaching academy as well, is that right?
I do. So the Power Disc Golf Academy is an online tutorial program where you can go in, and we have over 120, I think, lessons on there right now with 5 different coaches, and we're bringing more coaches in pretty much every single month. So that's going great. We have great feedback there. So yeah, a lot of different avenues, but I just appreciate you guys listening to me today.
All right, and that's our show. That's a wrap on this week's Fish Golf Broadcast. Join us next week to fritter away more of your ever-waning life force on two jabronis talking about Frisbee. Please support the show, if you're able, by shopping for fish stuff at fishdiscgolf.com, Daddy Disc Golf, Disc Hub, Tree Magnets, and Disc Golf Bra's websites. You can still save 10% at Grip Equipment with the code FISHGIFT10, and please tell a friend about this show. Unless you don't have any friends, but that's your problem, not mine.